Well, has anyone heard of PostSecret.com? Anybody? No hands? Well, PostSecret.com is a website created by Frank Warren as a sort of communal confession project. The way it works is people write confessions on one side of a postcard, things they would never tell another soul, so that they can be read by a guy they've never met and potentially plastered all over the internet for the world to see. Makes sense, right? Well, I was curious about this phenomenon, so I had a little look at PostSecret.com, and as you can imagine, the confessions are all over the place. Some of them are funny, like this one. I taught my dog to poop with his leg up. Everyone just thinks he's peeing. I hate picking up poop. Now, not for nothing, I'm just thinking he's a little more proud than he is ashamed of this, but, you know. Some of them are a little disturbing, like this one. I work in cosmetics, and I lie to women all day long, which is why I never go to cosmetics counters. It's pointless, really. But some of them are actually really touching, like this one I wanted to share with you. I work at a teen crisis center. Every day, I work with gang members trying to show them all the potential that life has for them. I counsel brokenhearted teens, telling them that time will heal them. I work with HIV-positive teens trying to make the most of the time that they have here on Earth. I talk to suicidal youths about how precious life is and how much their life is worth. And yet, I wake up every day and wish that I didn't have to wake up ever again. I like to help others because I feel like no one can help me. Now, as I read this, I wonder whether this person would ever say any of this out loud in a church. Why are we so squeamish about telling the truth in church? I wanted to explore that question a little bit today. I'm using Psalm 44 as my point of departure for reasons that you might already be starting to guess. It's one of those psalms that doesn't show up in too many worship songs. Honestly, if anybody can find a mainstream worship song with anything from verses 9 and following in it, I will give you a candy bar. And this is being recorded, so I can't weasel out of it. Why is Psalm 44, at least the bit from verse 9 on, why is it so unpopular? Well, we'll take another look here. It seems to start out just fine. In verses 1 to 8, we have a rousing recital of all the wonderful things God has done for God's people in the past, how God drove out Israel's many enemies and planted God's people to grow and thrive, how God afflicted Israel's foes but set God's people free, that by God's power they can tread down our assailants, even declaring boldly in verse 8, "In God we have boasted continually, and we will give thanks to your name forever." How solid and affirming, right? But what follows in verse 9 appears to be in direct contradiction to all that's come before. "Yet you have rejected us and abased us and have not gone out with our armies. You made us turn back from the foe, and our enemies have gotten spoil." And it goes on. 5 verses of direct accusation against God. Think about that. Followed by a direct declaration of Israel's covenant faithfulness over against God's apparent unfaithfulness. "All this has come upon us, yet we have not forgotten you or been false to your covenant. Our heart has not turned back, nor have our steps departed from your way. Yet you have broken us in the haunt of jackals and covered us with deep darkness." The list of accusations ends defiantly, the psalmist spitting out, "Because of you, we are being killed all day long and accounted as sheep for slaughter." Because of you. The most likely cause for the writing of this communal lament psalm is military defeat on a massive and humiliating scale. Though the psalm doesn't give us enough information to be sure, it is possible that this psalm could have arisen in the wake of the destruction of the first Jerusalem temple by the Babylonians in 587/586 BCE. To read about it, you can check out 2 Kings 24 and 25. It's a violent, tragic account of the destruction of Jerusalem and the carrying off of the 2 tribes of Israel that remained after the Assyrian deportation 200 years earlier. What we see here is a corporate calling out of God in the face of unimaginable devastation, a bringing God to task on a national scale. I don't find it surprising that Israel is angry, considering what the nation has been through. What I find surprising is the level of honesty with which Israel communicates with God in this psalm. Here the psalmist is bold, defiant, perhaps even impudent in his accusation of God. "You have abandoned us. You have humiliated us. You have done this. You are not living up to your end of the bargain. We have kept the covenant. You haven't. Do something. I don't know about you, but this makes me a little bit uncomfortable, right? Is it really okay to question God, to be angry with God, to even blame God? This isn't the kind of stuff we hear in Sunday school, right? But it's there in the Bible. What do we do with it? Well, I think that we overlook psalms like this at our own peril. Because if we ignore them, then it becomes easier to propagate, whether consciously or unconsciously, three popular myths about suffering in our culture and consequently in our churches. They go like this. One, suffering is a sign of God's punishment. Two, talking about our pain is a sign of weakness. Three, being angry with God demonstrates a lack of faith on our part. So let's unpack these. First, myth number one, suffering is a sign of God's punishment. Now, one of the first things we need to do is differentiate between punishment and consequences. Okay, so we have in our dining room a stairway that leads to the basement. And at the top of the stairs, lining the opening of the stairway, is a banister with these hard square-shaped dowels all around it. We have a 7-year-old. So if our 7-year-old chooses to run toward the banister, full tilt, barefoot, and not paying attention to where he's going, what do you think's going to happen? He's going to stub his toe, right? Not that that's ever happened 3 times. But is this pain a consequence of his being punished? No. It's just a natural consequence of making a bad decision. We make bad decisions from time to time, and we have to deal with those consequences, and sometimes this causes us and others pain. That's not what I'm talking about. Much of the time, suffering simply comes. We lose people we love. We get sick. We get taken advantage of. We find ourselves out of work, in pain, or otherwise hurting, and we've done nothing to deserve it. This isn't punishment. This is life. And suffering isn't an aberration from our normal life. It's part of a normal life. It's part of what makes us human. And if we buy into this myth that suffering means something's wrong with us, then we engage in a very specific, unhealthy behavior. We blame. We blame ourselves because we believe we're deficient. We blame others because we think their deficiency might rub off on us. We think they might have done something to deserve it. We push people away, perhaps when they most need us, and this fractures our communities. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story because it's relevant. My mother died at the age of 42 of complications from type 1 diabetes. I was 18. She's what you call a brittle diabetic. So for as long as I could remember, she suffered as her body slowly shut down under the constant barrage of attacks from her disease. And while many people around us had the best of intentions, I began to notice that over time, people began to see my mother, the person, less than they saw the disease that ravaged her. Physical healing became the thing, the one thing people seemed to care about. And my mother, the person, began to disappear under the weight of all the expectations. Maybe if she prayed more. Maybe if we all had a little more faith. Maybe. People found the reality of her illness scary and hard to see, so they just saw her less and less over time. And eventually she left them. It was hard to watch. We don't like to think suffering is normal, but it is. We'll all face it somehow, somewhere, sometime. And I think that deep down, honestly, we all hope that when we do, we won't have to face it alone. In Psalm 44, the psalmist refuses to accept that the current situation of suffering has anything to do with him. He doesn't make excuses for God. He doesn't take blame when he doesn't think it's warranted. He recognizes that in this case, there's no connection between his current circumstances and his behavior. Myth number two, talking about our pain is a sign of weakness. This myth comes from our ultra-achieving, ultra-consumerist, Pinterest-happy, image-driven culture. We want to project a good image. We want people to think our bathrooms are never smelly. Our kids eat kale and have perfect hair, and our dishes are always done. By the way, if anybody can get their kids to eat kale, I want to know how. Just let me know. God forbid we ever admit that we aren't perfect, especially if we're Christians. Because isn't that the whole point of being Christian? That somehow because of Jesus, I have my act together and you can too? Of course it isn't, but there's all sorts of messages coming from the televangelists and the advertisers that would have us think so. So we do what comes naturally in this world. Like Adam and Eve, we hide. But the psalmist refuses to hide his pain or the pain of his people. In fact, this is in large part what the laments are all about. One third of the Psalter and a whole book of them in Lamentations. They're about the honest disclosure of our pain, not just for therapeutic purposes, though it's a very healthy thing to do, but because we believe God is listening. There's someone on the other end of the line who hears us and has the power to act. What a beautiful thing it is to know that when life throws its worst at us, we don't have to hide. We can tell God, and in fact, we can tell others. See, the Psalms weren't written in a vacuum and hidden away. They were and continue to be spoken and sung in the community of faith out loud over and over. They're the way, liturgically speaking, the community owns its story, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And they can be that for us, too. Myth number three, being angry with God is a sign of weak faith. I'm going to be honest with you. Until I read the Psalms cover to cover, all 150 of them, I had no idea it was okay to be mad at God. I'll be honest, I thought deep down, though I may never have said it, that if I was mad at God, there must be something wrong with me. But here's what happens if we don't articulate our anger, even and perhaps especially when it's directed at God. We get stuck in our faith journey because it's hard to love someone we believe is hurting us. It's hard to trust someone we think has abandoned us. And so we do what comes naturally. We lie. We lie to ourselves by trying to think we aren't really angry at God, or we lie to ourselves by thinking we don't need God anyway. Either way, we're lying. We may lie to others by spouting off without reflection and context that all things work together for good to those that love him, without really having any idea what that means. The truth is, there's an other side to anger, and that is reconciliation. But reconciliation only comes when we're honest about our pain. We have to walk through the pain openly and bravely because reconciliation doesn't come easy, and we can't get there without bearing our wounds. In Psalm 44, the community of faith declares its anger with brutal honesty. It feels, for all the world, like God has abandoned them. Is that true? No. But as a parent comforts a raging toddler, even when that child flails its fists in defiance against her, so God comforts us in our rage. And at the end of all our raging, God remains. And we learn to trust. See, I believe at their core that all three of these myths arise out of a place of shame. Brené Brown, author of Daring Greatly, has done research for over a decade which shows that shame is a universal human emotion. We all have it. None of us is immune to its effects. Here's what Brené Brown says about shame. Shame derives its power from being unspeakable. That's why it loves perfectionists. It's so easy to keep us quiet. Of course, there's no perfectionists in seminary, right? But how do we let our words and actions flow freely from grace and not from fear-fueled shame? I think we do it the way the psalmist does. We get real with God in prayer. Because here's the thing about prayer. It's not venting. When we vent, we just spew our anger to the void with no expectation of change or regard for whom it might affect. But when we speak our honest feelings in prayer, we know that God is listening and has the power to change things. We also know God is the one person who can absorb all our ugliness and make something beautiful out of it. This is why the psalmist's desperate tirade ends finally in hope. And I want to read the last few verses of Psalm 44 from the Message version. Get up, God. Are you going to sleep all day? Wake up. Don't you care what happens to us? Why do you bury your face in the pillow? Why pretend things are just fine with us? And here we are, flat on our faces in the dirt, held down with a boot on our necks. Get up and come to our rescue. If you love us so much, help us. Sounds pretty desperate, right? But it's hopeful. Why is it hopeful? Because the psalmist is still praying. Even after all the pain and all the accusations, the psalmist still believes God loves Israel and will honor the covenant. He still believes. He hasn't checked out. See, that's the beauty of these psalms. They give us a way not to check out when we suffer. We know that. Because these words are in the Bible, we have a way to remain engaged in our faith, even when it hurts, perhaps especially when it hurts. I'm going to go back to my story for a little bit. A number of years after my mom died, my dad gave me her old King James Bible. And I decided one Advent to read through the Psalms in that old King James Bible. And through that experience, I had one of the most powerful conversations of my life with her 13 years after she died. You see, every page was filled with underlining, with names, myself and my brother and others' dates, the date of her first kidney transplant, the date of my young aunt's sudden death in a car accident, question marks in the margins, amens in all caps, longings, fears, affirmations. It was all there. And I realized, palpably, that the Psalms represent an ongoing conversation, one that goes two directions, from God to God's people and from God's people to one another. The Psalms represent an unbroken dialogue stretching back thousands of years, one that is characterized by joy, pain, despair, hope, praise, thanksgiving, lament, anger, and crucially, honesty. This is why the Psalms can be our teachers and why it's so important that as God's people, we keep this conversation going. Friends, we need language to pray. The Psalms give us that. I was a child when my mom was sick, so I don't really know whether or with whom she might have confided her pain and struggles with her illness. But to be honest, I think a little more grace and willingness to bear her burden with her, instead of being so afraid of it, might have done a bit of good. And what about that dedicated yet deeply struggling youth worker who confided in a stranger on Post Secret? Would she feel safe sharing her story in church? And if not, why not? Is it because the church isn't always honest? It's because the church, even in the church, we can get caught up in shame-based fears about weakness, pain, and vulnerability. Can we, even in the church, or the classroom, or the conference room, admit that we don't have it all together? Walter Brueggemann has said that the church shouldn't be the happiest place in the world. The church should be the most honest place in the world. Of all places, the church should be the safest in which to share our stories. Imagine how many stories might be going untold, how much pain might be going unhealed. I love the church, and I always have, but I think we still have work to do. Perhaps now more than ever, these difficult, unpopular psalms, like Psalm 44 and so many others, can be our teachers. Don't buy into the myths of our culture. Suffering is not a sign of punishment. It's a natural part of life. Talking about our pain is not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of great courage. Being honest about our anger does not betray a lack of faith. It's a sign of a deep and abiding faith in a God who always hears us, even when our words are hard to hear and even harder to say. Let these words of hope be healing for all of us and for a hurting world. In Jesus' name.